On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After a six-day siege at the fabled Red Mosque in Islamabad, Pakistani troops stormed in today, guns blazing, Islamic militants fighting and falling in the heart of Pakistan's capital city. From the U.S., it can look like just one more bloody day in a bloody part of the world, but Pakistan is different. It's the new base for al-Qaeda and the Taliban's Afghan resurgence. It's fully nuclear-armed, and it's ruled by a military dictator backed by the United States who may be on the brink of falling like the Shah of Iran. Up next on Point, big trouble in the country that could tear it all open, Pakistan. We begin today in Islamabad, the Pakistani capital, with Shahan Mufti, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He has been closely following the siege and assault at the Red Mosque, the storming early today. Shahan Mufti, thank you very much for being with us. Give us the latest. What is known on how things stand inside the Red Mosque, on the death toll among security forces and among the students and militants inside?
Hi, Tom. At this point, actually, the situation stands that it is a severe lack of any reliable information coming at this point, but it seems like the death toll from today, from the last 24 hours and the last 12 hours, really, the siege, is over 150 now. They're saying about 15 army personnel and the rest militants inside the mosques have died. It seems like the army spokespeople are saying now that the siege is towards the end now, and this should finish any moment. The leader of the group inside the mosque, Ghazi Abdul Rashid, has just died a few minutes ago, and the army has confirmed this report.
In what circumstances did he die? The last we heard, he was said to be in the basement, ready to go to his martyrdom to make a last stand?
That's true. He's actually the last anyone heard from him in public was his statement to the media, which came about 12 hours ago, in which he said exactly made those statements that he was ready for martyrdom. But now he was, after that report started coming out, that he was still alive. He has the Interior Ministry has confirmed, though, that he's been shot dead now.
Shahan Mufti, let's listen for just a moment to the voice of Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf over the weekend, threatening all those who were still then holed up in the Red Mosque. Sound and translation here is courtesy of the BBC.
I appeal to those who stayed inside the mosque to come out. Otherwise, I'm warning them here and now. They will get killed.
Pervez Musharraf, Pakistan's president, they will get killed. And that turns out to be the case. At least 150 now. You're hearing, and we understand information is difficult to be firm on, Shahan Mufti. How and when will it be clear that this is over?
There will be. The internal services spokesperson will probably speak soon. And the press, there have been intermittent, actually pretty regular press conferences ever since the crisis started about a week ago. So they will probably be, as soon as the army is sure that the mosque and the adjoining madrasa has been secured, there will be a press conference announcing everything that they are willing to announce.
Shahan, the country there and the region have been riveted on this. Some Americans may not know the backstory. What brought the militants inside the Red Mosque and government security forces into such a violent standoff and then clash?
Well, I mean, you can really choose to go as far back as you can on this story. It really, the links between this mosque and the religious establishment, the radical militant religious establishment, really go back to the creation of this mosque that came with the creation of the city back in the 60s. Most recently, though, these events started about 5 months ago when students from the female madrasa took over a children's public library and demanded that the mosque that had been demolished to build that library, be rebuilt. This slowly evolved. The Lal Masjid, the Red Mosque, got involved with this. The male students got involved with this then. And this slowly evolved into a larger campaign to eradicate vice from Islamabad and to implement some sort of Sharia law in the city.
That is Islamic
this
law.
This went on for months on end, and despite calls for the government to deal with the situation. And then finally, it was the kidnapping of a few Chinese, seven Chinese citizens from a massage parlor, that led to some pressure from Beijing that many believe led to the army being deployed around the mosque.
And why did the government feel
about a week ago?
Why did the government feel so threatened by this? You've got a mosque, you've got the madrasa with the female and male students, but why not just let it simmer? How could this be a matter of such consequence to the central government of Pakistan that they needed to go in guns blazing?
Well, a lot had been tried, Tom, in the last 4 or 5 months. The government was being criticized for not doing enough, for not being hard enough on this issue, because it was taking place a few blocks from the Supreme Court and really the capital area in Islamabad. So really it was, and there was many envoys sent to the mosque, including the cleric of the highest, the most important mosque in Islam in Mecca. So really, and then some Saudi officials, as well as political figures from within Pakistan, had approached the mosque trying to negotiate some settlement. The last hope for a settlement, actually 24 hours ago, yesterday, there was the mood turned a little euphoric because there was thought that some clerics within Pakistan had neared a settlement and almost sealed a deal with the clerics in the mosque. Unfortunately, that broke apart very quickly before dawn, and then finally the army, within minutes after the announcement that the final negotiation had failed, the army went in guns blazing.
So now you've got a situation where you have the leader of those in the mosque, Abdul Rashid Ghazi, you say reported dead, shot dead. You've got, of course, over the last week, an assassination attempt on Pervez Musharraf as he flew over the city. You've got the Taliban reported moving out of the hinterlands and into the Pakistani population. You've got the judiciary in an uproar over Musharraf's attempt to sack the chief justice of the Pakistan's judicial system. Do we have a government on the brink here, Shahan Mufti? Is Musharraf in as much trouble as it appears?
It's hard to say. As you said, I mean, even before this mosque face-off began, before the violence broke out, Pervez Musharraf was in a tough spot. Like you said, he was facing he has a whole buffet of problems to choose from right now, including a judicial challenge, a united opposition. What effect this episode will have is really dependent on how Pervez Musharraf tries to deal with this. There is a very strong secular move. There was a very strong opposition movement built around very secular issues, including the independence of the judiciary, independence of the media, that was in full force right before this started. So it is possible in some scenario that those issues will resurface, because this has really drowned everything else out, including an all-parties conference taking place in London in opposition to Pervez Musharraf. So it's possible that these same old issues will come back, and also the flood, which is the south of the country is reeling from. But it is also possible that this religious issue, will start dominating the opposition to Pervez Musharraf, and he will have to deal with this issue foremost.
Is there fear of a wider Islamic fundamentalist uprising around the country? Of course, the whole country is not, much of the country is not necessarily sympathetic, but many are. Are people now expecting, with this very high death toll in the mosque, for the fire of protest to erupt elsewhere?
Well, the fact is that the country is under a high security alert right now, the entire country. The city of Islamabad, while driving around today, you are seeing a lot of, there are army presence in all major places. There's definitely a feeling right now that there's already some activity that's happened in the frontier province and along the Silk Road. Where there has been some uprisings. The government has deployed presence in all religious places of worship and education. There is a fear, definitely, that there could be a lot of backlash once the smoke settles, that there might be a lot happening especially, like you said, in the hinterlands, maybe not as much in the cities. But we have to wait and see about what exactly will happen. Like I said, though, there is a whole plethora of issues, unaddressed problems still in Pakistan that might take some attention off this, and this might recede into the background.
But those not necessarily comforting issues in themselves. Shahan Mufti reporting there from Islamabad, where a bloody assault on the Red Mosque has unfolded today. Thank you very much for being with us from the Christian Science
Thank
Monitor.
You. Thank
you, Shahan.
Time.
With me in the studio, Adil Najam, professor at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, specialist in South Asian affairs. Adil Najam, you're watching and getting this news with the rest of us. The leader reportedly dead of the Red Mosque there. Where does this leave Pakistan?
In a mess. In a big mess. But Pakistan politics has been in a mess for some time, as your reporter was just mentioning. The death of the leader is an important news, and it will depend on how it will be played out. Musharraf and his government has been in a mess for a while. This has distracted attention from the other problems he's been having, the Chief Justice crisis, the Balochistan crisis, the cyclone that hit, the falling out of really the coalition that he had built, the rise of the opposition parties and their increasing demands. But it is not clear at this point, especially with Ghazi dead, the leader dead, that this will necessarily help his state either in Pakistan or abroad.
Adil, we're reading some very, very hard analysis of what's going on there. Ahmed Rashid writing recently, the Bush administration's policy of sticking by Musharraf is fast becoming eerily reminiscent of the Carter administration's policy of sticking by the Shah of Iran. And here from Steve Cohen at the Brookings Institution, what's he say? The United States is paying lip service to a regime that is collapsing before its eyes.
I think the regime is in danger of collapsing, whether it does or not. Musharraf has proven to be a very resilient fellow. The Iran analogy is commonly being used both here in the U.S. and sometimes in Pakistan. I think one difference here is that in Iran it was very clear who was the alternative. And that was Khomeini and the religious crowd. In Pakistan, it's not clear who the alternative is. As your reporter pointed out, there are a couple of streams which do not actually have common agendas. So the Chief Justice movement is very much a secular movement. It is, you would even call it a liberal movement.
This is Musharraf sacked or tried to sack the Chief Justice. The lawyers from all over the country rallied around him in an enormous way. So this is kind of secular, moderate, democratic in a way.
Yeah. It's actually the biggest thing. It was the biggest thing happening in Pakistan until this. And I've been calling it the democratic moment in Pakistan because people came out wearing thick black coats in the middle of a hot summer.
To say no more. We will not go down this road.
And not only were they saying no to Musharraf, they were really saying yes to democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this issue with the Lal Masjid is interesting because until
Lal Masjid, that is the Red Mosque.
The Red Mosque in Islamabad. Until this morning, I think the government had done a fairly good job of playing this as a criminality issue and not a religiosity issue. So the reason the death of the leader is important is whether it will play out in Pakistan as Musharraf versus the religious extremes or the government against a bunch of criminals, kidnappers, extortionists.
Well, to understand, so then you seem to be suggesting that there's a question whether, if it should all blow up, who takes the reins, whether it's the, in a way, resurgent, democratic, secular Pakistani population or an Islamic fundamentalist population somehow that could move into power. And, of course, it has sympathizers, we know, within the Pakistani intelligence service at the very least. Who was inside this mosque? We saw lots of young men, young women, lots of them, and families outside the walls looking to support them, get them out of there, who hardly looked like radicals. Yeah. These were moms and dads.
This is interesting, and again, it depends on how, when the information comes clear. I went to the mosque. I went inside the mosque about less than a month ago.
Okay.
I went to say my prayers. It's a mosque. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see what was happening in a mosque that I had been to as a young kid. It's a big compound. It's a huge compound.
Right.
It's a multiple set of buildings. It began with several thousand people. I think the government did a fairly good job of evacuating most of them, the kids, the women, most of the student types.
Right.
What was left now after 7 days of fighting were the hardcore, most militant extremists and supposedly a number of people they had kept hostages, including women and children. There are reports that a number of them were foreign fighters, that over this period, as the government had delayed, the mosque people had been joined by more militant elements.
So foreign fighters potentially in there as well, but obviously some very Pakistani locals who were also appeared to be fully prepared to die. This is potent. Adil, let's take a call from Atlanta, Georgia. We've got Dan on the line. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
How are you, Tom?
Very well. What's your question, Dan?
Well, the question is, the concern over there in Pakistan, but also essentially the situation we have in general dealing with radical Islamists. How can you possibly negotiate with a people who have absolutely no fear of death? It seems to me the only way we could deal with them is essentially eliminate them, because they simply breed the reactionary views, and I mean, they're threatening to start another dark ages for our entire civilization.
But you can't eliminate a whole people. I mean, aren't those exactly people that you need to negotiate with, or at least figure out what's on their mind, Dan?
Figuring out, you can extract information, but once that proves to be unuseful, it would seem to me you must dispose of them accordingly. I know this sounds very radical and, you know, in this day of care and cuddling that, you know, it just seems completely outrageous for me to say this, even on air. But the reality is this: we had to deal with the Japanese under similar circumstances during World War II. Our history is full of radicals, and the only way that was finally to overtake them was to expunge them.
Okay. There's a radical view. Remember, Dan, they have nuclear weapons too this time. Adil, you hear the fear and alarm in that voice. Yeah. You're Pakistani. How do you respond to that?
First of all, with due respect, they don't have nuclear weapons. The government of Pakistan does. Luckily, I understand.
I don't mean the kids in the Red Mosque, but this is a nuclear-armed part of the world.
I think the type of thinking that Dan portrayed, I do not agree with for a moment, but that is the type of thinking that these extremists portray. And the question is, how many people are you going to eliminate? You know, Gandhi was right. If an eye for an eye is the only solution, then you have a blind village. And we don't want to have a blind world. One of the good things that was happening here was that the government did show actually some quite sophisticated and good strategy in sifting out the non-extremists from this. So when this started inside the mosque, there were several thousand people.
Mm-hmm.
By the time this has ended, it was some hundreds of the most extreme. So one of the things
that they were trying to make fine distinctions here.
Yeah, I think the battle is who takes the middle. And what the extremists are trying to do by making it religious issues is saying it is religion. Therefore,
there is no middle.
There is no middle. Everyone has to be with us. And you have to break the religious argument out of the criminality argument. And I think in some ways that's a very important lesson for the larger war on terror.
Let's hear that effort to make distinctions here. Here's General Waheed Arshad, spokesman for the Pakistan Army, saying in a briefing after the raid began on the Red Mosque that they were trying to avoid civilian casualties.
There is this the women and children who are in the madrasa complex, and we are taking a step-by-step approach, a very calibrated approach to ensure that there is no collateral damage unnecessarily.
Trying to be calibrated in their approach, but many dead in spite of that. Let's go to Kate in Cheshire, Connecticut. Kate, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to respond to a previous caller who said that the only way to deal with people who don't have a fear of death is to eliminate them.
Yeah.
And I don't think that makes any sense at all. I mean, that's just going to breed more extremists. And if you don't, you know, is his only option in negotiation to put a fear of death into people? Is there another way to negotiate that doesn't involve threats?
Kate, it's a good question. Let us pick it up. Adil, what about within Pakistan itself? How do the secular forces that be there look on the Islamic fundamentalists who want to bring Sharia law, Islamic law? Do they see them as cousins who just have a different idea of what to do, or as a kind of mortal threat to a democratic secular view of Pakistan?
Much more the latter. As Shahan, your reporter, was mentioning, there have been a lot of calls on the government to do this earlier. In fact, one of the biggest criticisms, and I think it's a right criticism, is that the government took too long. This thing had been going on for 6 months.
So secular Pakistanis, one of them in there.
Right.
Get tough.
In the middle of the federal capital, a bunch of people go and take a children's library hostage. This is 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Then they go and take this woman hostage and says, well, she's a prostitute. We are going to mete out justice.
Mm-hmm.
They take these Chinese. So there was this sense that the writ of the state had been going away. But what the secular forces were saying is, what is the state doing? What is Musharraf doing? In fact, I think one of the things is that lots of people have, because, you know, cynicism runs in our veins, kind of, said, well, this must have been some sort of a stage drama. The government is encouraging this to happen because it will distract attention. from the Chief Justice movement and all that. So that's where the battle lines are really drawn. Those who want secular liberal democracy and those who would use religion as the metaphor. The important thing is the religious parties have consistently opposed the people in this mosque.
That is the formal religious authorities.
The formal religious parties.
But step back with us for a second. You do have people within Pakistan's government, within its intelligence service, maybe some sectors of its military, who support the Islamic fundamentalists.
Yeah.
Why? What's their interest there? Is it just purely a spiritual impulse, or is there some geostrategic thing at work?
A bit of both, a bit also of the opposition to Musharraf, a desire for, you know, some sort of grand idealistic society based on religion, moral principles. It's a mesh, and some of it is just raw power. It is, I think, a deeply divided society.
Now, Musharraf came to power by stepping right over the constitution. He's going to have there's an election coming up, though. What's the decision that the country that Musharraf has to make about the next step here?
Oh, the immediate next step, and in some ways, what precedes all of this is whether General Musharraf doffs his uniform or not.
So that is to enter the election as a civilian.
Well,
can he do that constitutionally?
Well, you know, we keep changing constitutions. We talk a lot about it, but we in Pakistan keep changing them. The issue right now is that he's the president of Pakistan, which is a civilian post, as well as the chief of the military.
Yeah.
And he had promised that he would cease to be the chief of the military. It is very clear where his power comes from.
Mm-hmm.
His power comes from his uniform. There's a demand by the opposition, religious as well as secular, that he should not be allowed to hold two offices together. He has indicated that he wants to do that, and that in some ways is the biggest battle going on in Pakistan.
Let's go to Pawleys Island, South Carolina, and Mark. Mark, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I just wanted to comment on this simply because Pakistan being a world power and having nuclear weapons, I think this is a much more critical crisis that we face as a planet than any of the other hot spots going on in the world right now.
It clearly has got volatility written all over it. Mark, thanks for the call. I'm reading here, Adil Najam, Pakistan, this is just a couple of weeks ago, building a third plutonium production reactor at a major nuclear weapons center. They'll be able to build a new generation of lighter, more powerful weapons, more easily launched on missiles. This is serious stuff.
This is serious stuff. This is the toughest neighborhood in the world. I would again say, sort of, in all of this, the nuclear issue has not been a flashpoint.
Pakistan potentially falling into Islamic radical hands.
But also potentially falling back to democracy.
Yes, but that's a big span. That's a concerning span. Let's root for the latter.
Yeah, but also let's focus on this point. The radicals in this case were sort of cornered even within the larger religious crowd. So as we were talking about earlier, the larger religious parties have been torn, but their sympathies haven't been with the radicals. Mm-hmm. They have opposed what they have done, and that's good news. That's good news because the religious organized parties are seeking electoral paths to power, and I think that is good for democracy.
So there may be opportunity in all this crisis and chaos in Pakistan right now. Lorne is calling from Boston. Lorne, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Tom, and your guest. In following this incident, it kind of looks like this is the culmination of the failure of post-World War II foreign policy. Instead of encouraging liberal democracies in strategic nations, we've been playing it safe and cultivating relationships with dictators. If Musharraf falls, which is a more likely scenario than the country going democratic, we've worked against our interests and we've just provided radical Islam with its first conventional nuclear weapon and the technology with which to develop more. We should have years ago cultivated liberal democracy in Pakistan and risked Musharraf's fall than certainly what we're facing now.
Lorne, George Bush says that's what he's attempting right now in Iraq, and we see the difficulty there.
I think the fact that George Bush said it is its own answer.
Okay, we've got that perspective. Thanks for your call. Adil, how much of the I don't know, responsibility for Pakistan's state of affairs today rests with the United States. The Washington has been a major supporter of Musharraf, especially since 9/11.
Yeah, some of it does, but I don't want to sort of make it too easy for Pakistanis by saying, you know, it's essentially
it's all Washington's
foreign policy.
Fault. Mm-hmm.
Pakistan has a lot to answer for. But I think the larger point that the caller is making, and this is my criticism of how the story has played out in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
this is not about whether the U.S. supports Musharraf or not. If you look at all the editorials in front of you, they're really about, should we support Musharraf, should we not?
We've poured $10 billion in there since 9/11. That doesn't matter.
I think the question is, should the U.S. support democracy in Pakistan? And in some ways, in that short-term thing of whether it's mm-hmm. Musharraf or not Musharraf, mm-hmm. we are losing out on the big question. I think if the U.S. sort of statement and pushes, we want democracy in Pakistan, and let it be whoever it is. One will find that I have argued that Pakistan is a democratic society trapped inside an undemocratic state. And the push should be not for Musharraf or against Musharraf, but for democracy.
But the fear in Washington appears to be that if you back away from Musharraf, if you put some daylight in there, boom, you'll have another dictator or he'll be overthrown or there'll be chaos right behind it. I mean, this may be the wrong, it may be a zombie policy, but it seems to be the fear.
It's partly a fear that is cultivated by General Musharraf and successive military governments, that if you don't have us, look, this is what will happen. If you don't have Musharraf, maybe it's the lawyers that will happen. So in some ways, it's a very nice argument for the military government to keep convincing Washington that, look here, we are the only thing between you and nuclear catastrophe. What I'm saying is that in that fear, we've gotten so trapped in that fear that we've lost sight of our real interest, which should be democracy.
Give democracy a chance in Pakistan and have some faith in the Pakistani people. We're joined right now from Alexandria, Virginia, by Bruce Rydell, senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He was senior director for South Asian and Near East Affairs for the National Security Council from 1997 to 2001. Bruce Rydell, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
What is your sense of how Washington, the U.S. government, is looking on at this at the State Department, at the Pentagon? How are they seeing the current volatile state of affairs in Pakistan?
I think with horror. The stakes here are understood in Washington to be enormous. A decade ago, I wrote a memo to President Clinton in which I said that Pakistan is the most dangerous country in the world precisely because all these issues come together in Pakistan. Al-Qaeda and the future of global jihadist terrorism, nuclear weapons and the future of non-proliferation, and war and peace on the Indian subcontinent, the only place in the world where there's a real chance of war between two nuclear powers in our time. All of those issues are well understood in Washington, and I think there is a real sense of horror that the man we have hoped would be able to maintain stability in Pakistan for the last 7 or 8 years, President Musharraf, is in deep trouble today.
Bruce, the shorthand of horrors there, you understand well, but I wish you'd paint the picture. We all hope that this may tilt toward a secular and democratic result that draws in religious figures as well, that takes Pakistan past this rough patch. But you say they're watching in horror. If it goes the wrong way, what's the scenario, maybe the nightmare scenario, that they're worried about, or scenarios?
Well, let me say at the beginning that I agree with your other guest that I think Washington has been too preoccupied with the nightmare scenario. Pakistan is a country which has a history of civilian rule. Yeah. It hasn't been perfect. It's not the most perfect democracy in the world, and its political parties are corrupt, and many of its politicians are corrupt. But the same could be said about most countries in the world, including our own on some occasions. I think there is an opportunity here for a return to democracy, and the United States should be outspoken in support of that. That said, this situation has deteriorated very seriously over the last several years.
If it unfolds the wrong way, what might that look like?
I think the worst scenario that's plausible for us is that we get a different military dictator in Pakistan whose own personal predilections are much closer to the Islamist movements. The Pakistani officer corps is not a simple homogeneous mass. There are people within that officer corps which are much more inclined to the Islamist point of view. And I think you could end up with somebody like that. That would be dangerous.
What?
Another scenario would be a series of changes in political leadership, which leads to a breakdown in the kind of political order we've seen in Pakistan over the last several decades, which in a remote case could lead to a real Islamist regime.
If that should unfold, and again, everybody hopes against it, and there's a good chance it will not go that way, but if it does, what kind of contingency plans does the United States have? I mean, we're talking about a significant nuclear power here, developing more nuclear power. You've suddenly got an Islamic regime. Imagine that. What does the U.S. do?
Well, first of all, I think what we need to be doing now is reaching out to the civilian political centers in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
We should be, through the State Department, talking to some of the political leaders who may be important figures in the next stage, and that includes the exile leaders, Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif.
Mm-hmm.
We should be talking to the democracy movement that's on the streets that's emerged in the last several months. We should begin to put some money down on other bets on the playboard here. In the worst case, if we had an Islamist regime, there isn't a whole lot we can do about it. Because if they take over, if an army general takes over who is sympathetic to Islamists, he has his control over nuclear weapons. And the notion that somehow we could use force to take those back, I think, is simply out of the question.
What about India? How would India respond in that circumstance? These, of course, once shared a nation, long bitter rivals after their split up, both nuclear armed. How would New Delhi respond if suddenly you had that kind of regime in Islamabad?
I think the Indians are scared as we are about what they see going on here. They've come accustomed to Musharraf. They don't particularly like his habit of dropping new proposals on them in press conferences all the time, but they become accustomed to him, and they become accustomed to military rule. They support the idea of democracy in Pakistan, but I think they're very worried about way the situation developing. I don't think that the Indians either have a military option to take away Pakistan's nuclear weapons without those weapons being used.
Let's go to Sumner in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Sumner, you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted, first of all, to say that your last speaker, your guest,
Bruce Riedel,
is extremely reasoned in what he just said. I think we tend not to understand the complexity of Pakistani society in many ways. It's a very tribal, very ethnically divided society. They have a Baluchi independence movement, for example.
Right.
You have Pathans, you have Punjabis, you have Sindhis, etc. You also have a history, although there is a democracy, it's sort of a modified democracy. You have political and economic oligarchies. Today you have a system which probably can be described as a junta with Musharraf, mm-hmm. basically, as the first among equals, shall we say.
What are you suggesting, Sumner, that Pakistan is not ready for democracy?
I'm suggesting, yes, essentially. They have their own way. Their last two leaders, Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, have been accused by many in Pakistani society, high and low, of corruption.
It's imperfect, but are you saying you prefer the junta? Look at the situation we're in right now.
I'm saying that, first of all, to compare Musharraf, for example, to the Shah of Iran is completely ridiculous. The Shah operated an organization called SABAK,
Tough Intelligence Service, Internal Security.
Gestapo, mm-hmm. May I finish for a second?
Yep.
Akin to the Gestapo, which arrested, killed, raped people, even from his own socioeconomic group. People were extremely afraid. I don't think there's anybody in Pakistan today, except for extreme Islamists, who is really afraid of Musharraf.
Well, now, I don't know. I have read stories about political detainees who were treated pretty badly there, but maybe not on the same scale as Savak. We get your perspective, Sumner. Adil Najam, how about it? Sumner says it's complicated, maybe too complicated for democracy to be effective. Maybe Pakistan's not ready for democracy.
Some of what he says I agree with, but this notion that Pakistan and Pakistanis are not ready for democracy, I take it somewhat as an insult. I'm sure he didn't mean it that way. There is nothing genetically wrong with Pakistanis in terms of democracy. Democracy has not...
Leave genetics out of it, but what about demographically,
but
socially,
ethnically? Yeah, no, but that's the point of democracy. Mm-hmm. Democracy is messy. You stumble, you stand up, and you keep going.
Mm-hmm.
no one said democracy is perfect. Is it perfect anywhere? Give democracy a chance. Democracy has not been failed in Pakistan. It's never been tried in Pakistan. That's the issue. The point I really want to make very, very briefly is something that Bruce said, and he said it three times, and he's exactly right. The Islamist scenario, he said, is a remote one. It's the unlikely one. And in some ways, we might be too focused on that. If you want to look at the story of what happened at the mosque, here is another way to look at the story. It shows that extremism is not that rampant, that people are actually not that willing to Daesh. You had about 12,000...
All of Islamabad did not flock around this.
Not only 12,000, a big number. Not only that, but a lot of people flocked out of the mosque. There were about 10,000, and in the end, there were only a few hundred who were left. So the point is, we need to look at where we can build democracy rather than be trapped in our fears of what might happen. Because I do think there is a strong democratic force in Pakistan. And the U.S., I don't think the U.S. needs to support anyone, but U.S. needs to get out of the way.
Bruce Riedel, let me put the same thing to you. We were to have Ahmed Rashid with us today. He wrote in the Washington Post saying that it looked like a kind of Shah of Iran situation to him, and he knows the region well. Our caller says, no way, no how, this is not the same. But he's concerned democracy may not work there. How do you look at the democratic alternative path, option?
Well, I think it is similar in this sense. The stakes are very important. Just as the Iranian Revolution had an enormous impact on American foreign policy for 30 years and still does, how this crisis in Pakistan plays out could have an enormous stake. The best outcome, as I think we all agree, is to support a democratic transition. And that's where I think the administration should be focusing on now. It should be trying to find ways to encourage Musharraf to do what he should do, take off his uniform, and then let the electoral process move forward. I am not sanguine that it's going to be easy or simple. And I think we all agree that the Pakistani democratic system has had many flaws over the years. But that's a much more long-term, stable approach to a healthy Pakistan than a continued military dictatorship.
When you say Musharraf should take off his uniform and let democratic politics go forward, does that, are you assuming with him in it as a civilian candidate like any other?
If that's what he wants to do, then I think he ought to be given the opportunity to do that. But he has made repeated commitments that he is going to take off his uniform
and, it doesn't
and
happen.
That he's going to lead to an end to military rule, and I think he ought to be held to that standard.
Issa is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Issa, you're on the air.
Yes. I just, as I told to one of your colleague guys, that what kind of support did Musharraf get from America, and how did he act with that support? Right now, after what's happened in our country, in America, in 9/11 and all that stuff, and lots of the leader there, they try to use this for their own sake. And Musharraf is one of them, to be honest. I've been contacting a lot of Pakistani and Indian people. I've been in the Gulf for several years. And I know exactly that how much support get from America, it equal how much hatred he's going to get from his people. And what I need to say, the role being played by the United States is should United States changed the way to support or the way they support.
Issa, we've got it. Let us pick it up. Anil Najam, what about it? We've heard recently in the Palestinian situation that American support is actually kind of poison to Palestinian leadership. What about in Pakistan? Can a Pakistani leader now have a strong relationship with Washington and have the support of the Pakistani people? Our caller Issa says he doubts it.
That's a very, very good point that you raise. I don't think the parallel is to the Palestinian situation fully, but you're exactly right. U.S. support is no longer a great benefit to leaders in Pakistan.
Except for the cash.
The cash works and the weapons work and the international prestige works, but the biggest... one of the biggest charges against Musharraf in this action is that he is doing this against the mosque on the behest of the U.S. He is doing this. So these killings that have happened, these deaths that have happened, are also in your ledger, as far as the Pakistan public is concerned, that this is part of this greater war on terror. So it's no longer clear that there is a great political mileage for the U.S. to be had by supporting governments. I think the U.S. should learn, as should everyone else, from the lawyers in Pakistan, and the investment has to be in institutions, not in individuals.
These lawyers who have stood up and risked their livelihoods, presumably maybe their lives, to support secular justice.
And they're making a very deep, interesting democratic point. They're saying we want good institutions.
It's almost a kind of Gandhian gesture, right?
It is. It is. And it's about institutions. I think this is the moment that is to be captured. Because that is real understanding of deep democracy, that institutions matter, individuals do not.
We'll stand up and we'll defend it right there in the Pakistani sun. Chinny's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Chinny, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So we've been hearing quite a bit this week about Benazir Bhutto, who vows to return to Pakistan, you know, despite threats of arrest upon arrival. So my question is whether she presents a viable alternative and whether that's something that the U.S. might support and what that alternative might look like.
Let us look at that. Thank you, Chinny. Bruce Rydell, you mentioned Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, former leaders of Pakistan. Are they in the wings in a way that might lead them back onto the political stage here? Do you see that as a strong path?
I think Mrs. Bhutto very much is in the wings. I think she has very carefully maintained a degree of support inside Pakistan. I don't think the United States should be anointing any candidate, however. I think we ought to let this process work out. One of the great dilemmas the Bush administration has right now is that having stood so closely to President Musharraf for so many years, shoulder to shoulder, if it makes even the slightest gesture now to distance itself from him, then it may set in train the very thing it doesn't want to see happen, which is the collapse of his regime. This is the downside of having stood so close to a military dictator for so long. We're now wrapped up in his future.
Bruce, what about the future of the U.S. and NATO effort, and for that matter, Kabul's own effort in Afghanistan right next door? Can Afghanistan succeed if Pakistan does not?
Absolutely not. Pakistan is critical to the outcome of NATO's efforts in Afghanistan. And remember, this is NATO's first out-of-Europe operation and its first ever ground war. If it fails in Afghanistan, the NATO alliance is probably going to be relegated to a footnote in history. It is absolutely imperative that Pakistan be a cooperative player in the war against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And frankly, our $10 billion investment in President Musharraf hasn't really paid off in terms of what it should have on that cooperative effort.
Gigantic stakes here. Adil Najam expresses he's sanguine, some hope and optimism about the chances of a secular democratic movement stepping up here, as opposed to much darker, bloodier scenarios possibly. Bruce Rydell, what about you?
I've heard both President Musharraf and his two predecessors tell American presidents that if you don't support me, the next person will be the bearded ones. The specter of Islamic fundamentalism is used by every Pakistani leader to terrify Americans into supporting the person in office. I think we need a more sophisticated approach. We shouldn't let the terror of Islamic extremism prevent us from doing the wise thing here, which is to support a phased, gradual transition to civilian democratic rule in Pakistan.
Bruce Rydell, former Senior Director for South Asian and Near East Affairs at the National Security Council, now at the Brookings Institution. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Adil Najam, last thought. Hopeful?
I cautiously hopeful, because if not, then what's the alternative? Yes, cautiously hopeful, not sanguine.
Adil Najam at the Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. Thank you very much for being with us today. Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.